Welcome to the political cesspool, known across the South and worldwide as the South's foremost populist conservative radio program. And here to guide you through the murky waters of the political cesspool is your host for tonight, James Edwards.
This is James Edwards, and welcome to another live installment of the Political Cesspool radio program. It is Saturday evening, July the 3rd, day before the 4th of July, Independence Day right around the corner, and we certainly have some fireworks in store for you this evening. Another explosive barn burner is shaping up to be here on the Political Cesspool radio program as we come to you live from AM 1380 WLRM Radio in Memphis, Tennessee. We're also going out to the AMS and affiliate stations of the Liberty News Radio Network and, of course, simulcasting online at thepoliticalcesspool.org and libertynewsradio.com. Again, I am your host, James Edwards, joined as always this first hour, whether it's a holiday weekend or not, by my co-host, Keith Alexander. And Keith was over at my house a few hours earlier today before showtime, and we have rounded out what we think is going to be a veritable cornucopia of topics that are going to pique your interest, entertain you, and inform you. Have we not, Keith?
That we have, James, and this is July the 3rd, the eve of July the 4th, when we typically celebrate our freedom as Americans, and I would suggest that everybody do their best to celebrate freedom while they can, because we have a regime in place in America today that seems intent upon doing away with our traditional freedoms in America, James.
Well, Keith, we do, and that was never more evident than an article that you and I covered, or at least examined, I should say. We're about to cover it. We examined it earlier this afternoon at my kitchen table in preparation for tonight's show. I'd like to joggle the lineup of topics to be discussed this first hour, Keith, working on a couple of technical issues here in the studio, so I'm going to let you ride to the sound of the guns this first segment as you explain to our listening audience about how we found, actually you found this story and brought it to my attention, of this black journalist, if you will, from Palm Beach, Florida, who says that the Times demand that we have a living constitution. Keith, what was her thesis and why is it so dangerous?
Her thesis is the typical liberal thesis that every document that sets important guidelines and restrictions on governmental power or on the power of our society and government generally be a living document, because they don't like those strictures. For example, the same people that are always arguing for a living United States Constitution always seem to be arguing for a living Bible in the religious realm. So there's a similarity here. It's a typical canard of liberalism. And what they mean is that you can bend, you know, remember that song, Bend Me, Shape Me, Any Way You Want Me?
Oh, American Breed, great song, Keith.
Yeah, well, I knew that would be one that rung your chimes, but that is exactly what they intend for the Constitution and the Bible to be. You know, the Bible, for example, is great when it says things that support liberalism, like love thy neighbor or beat your swords into plowshares. But when it says something like a man shall not sleep with another man is with a woman, or a woman with another woman is with a man, it is an abomination in my eyes, saith the Lord, suddenly the Bible is converted into some antique, out-of-date book written by a bunch of dusty Bedouins.
Well, and of course, Keith, we all understand why they would want to trim the sails, so to speak, and make it a so-called living document, be it the Constitution or the Bible. They want to be able to conform it to whatever is politically correct at the moment.
And they need to conform it, James, because the Bible, neither the Bible nor the U.S. Constitution conforms in any form or fashion with liberalism. You know, the United States Revolution was not a liberal revolution, although that's kind of a article of faith with the left. It was a conservative revolution. And the Constitution was intended to be timeless, just like the Bible, setting timeless standards. And in particular, the Constitution of the United States was intended to prevent whoever governs us at any particular point in history from doing what they please to us. They knew, as Lord Acton said, that power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. So they wanted to put handcuffs on the government, and with a bunch of, you know, off-the-reservation liberals in charge of the American government, as we have today, the need to put handcuffs on those who govern us is more apparent than ever, James.
Well, certainly, Keith, you're right again. And I read that article in Horror today because this is something that they hope will gain momentum. Certainly it has over the years.
It all the time. Liberals say this all the time, that we have a living Constitution. And the writer of this article was one Rhonda Swan, who we did a little research on. She's a black female columnist, part of the Washington Post group. They've put her down on the farm system down in West Palm Beach, Florida. You know, she hasn't moved up to the major league unit up in Washington, D.C. yet. And reading her article, we can see why. She says that those who want our Constitution be interpreted according to the original intent of the framers, she trots out a canard. I don't want that. As a black person, I don't want to be three-fifths of a human being, and that's what the founding fathers intended.
Well, they always bring that up, Keith, and once again, they're wrong in terms of the context in which that was placed in the Constitution, but I'm sure she's never read the Constitution to begin with.
And she's never
sure she doesn't
really
read much at all.
What that three-fifths came from. The three-fifths was something imposed upon the South by northern political interests when the Constitution was being drafted. The three-fifths rule came about because the North didn't want the South to get credit, what, man for man or woman for woman, for every black person that was within their boundaries, because they didn't want the South to have as much representation in the House of Representatives as the North did. The North didn't have very many blacks. The South had a fair number of black slaves back in the 1780s, early 1790s, when the Constitution was being crafted, and they did not want these southern states to be able to count them 100%, so they allowed them to be counted 60% in a typical politically driven compromise, and it was not the so-called forces of oppression or these wicked honky slave owners that were denying the humanity. They wanted to affirm the humanity of the blacks and get them counted not three-fifths, but five-fifths of a human being so that they could get more representation in the House of Representatives. It was their so-called saviors in New England that insisted on the three-fifths rule.
But, of course, that's neither here nor there now, but just for the sake of historical
They love to trot this out, and they love to trot it out as being some example of the founding fathers thinking that they were less than, that black people were less than human. Nothing could be further from the truth. That's flat doodle, as Grandma used to say.
And, Keith, it all goes back to the primary focus of this first segment, this article, this topic, being the need for the politically correct, the liberals, the minorities. They all want a living constitution because the first one wasn't good enough in their limited wisdom, these evil white slaveholders. They just didn't understand. They could not have foreseen, she said in this article, the way America would have progressed, if you will. And so, therefore, it needs to be a living, breathing document. It needs to be open to interpretation and change as, of course, only the politically correct see fit. And that's basically what they're advocating for. And if the limp-wristed conservative opposition that I've seen over the past decade in my life as a political activist is the best they're going to do, then, Keith, this very well could be a constitution. We could see many changes to the Constitution forthcoming.
Well, you know, we have had a living constitution, unfortunately. The Brown versus Board of Education decision is a perfect example of a bunch of liberals on the Supreme Court just stepping outside or sidestepping the Constitution totally, ignoring the principle of stare decisis, which says that you have to base your opinions and previous precedents set by the court. The Supreme Court in Brown and numerous other decisions made during the Civil Rights era just totally ignored normal judicial principles. So, unfortunately, we have
Keith,
too much of
a
living constitution.
Got to take a break right there. We'll be right back.
Guys, we'll be back right after these messages.
Don't let me be misunderstood. Don't let me be misunderstood.
Please understand me, baby.
Don't let me be misunderstood.
Don't misunderstand me, baby.
Don't let me be.
Jump in the political cesspool with James and the gang. Call us tonight at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
I'm hearing feedback, Sean.
Hello, James. Are you there?
All right, are we going out on the air here, Sean? Okay, back to the show, everybody. Sorry for the technical difficulties there. We're trying our best to work through them. I was hearing somehow in my headset Keith Alexander's first segment commentary. I don't know exactly how that happened, but we're moving forward to the best we can. And now, Keith, we want to bring up an article that was written by our good friend Dr. Paul Gottfried, a gentleman who endorsed my book. He is a professor of humanities at Elizabethtown College in Pennsylvania, and he writes an interesting article that we posted on our website, thepoliticalcesspool.org. Yeah. Is he going?
Are you there, James?
Yeah, Keith, if you could introduce that article while I work here on my headset. Elena Kagan, A Woman for Our Times. What was Paul Gottfried's thoughts on that, and why was it so particularly interesting to us?
Well, we were talking about a living constitution and what a dangerous concept that is, and unfortunately how popular that concept is with liberals. Elena Kagan ought to be the poster child for the concept of a living constitution. Paul Gottfried, who is a Jewish paleoconservative writer that we have a lot of respect for and have interviewed on this show many times, basically tells the emperor that she has no clothes, or the empress in this case. And he says this in the article. He says, "Listening to Elena Kagan as she was speaking before the Senate Judicial Committee, I was struck by how perfectly she fits her time and place. An overweight Jewish lesbian whose career seems to have been put on fast track by her political supporters both inside and outside the media, and someone who, if she held diametrically opposed views, would not even be considered as a member of the grounds crew post at Harvard, she is a quintessential symbol of Obama's America." And, you know, as usual, when you hit the nail on the head, you drive it straight, and Paul Gottfried once again hit the nail on the head. Elena Kagan is the type of person that is in step with the liberals, and, you know, let's be honest about it, too, the liberal Jews of the Upper West Side of Manhattan in New York City that seem to have such a death grip on America's civilization and culture nowadays. She's a perfect product for her surroundings, a Jewish red diaper baby from the Upper West Side of Manhattan, which is a hotbed of radical liberalism if there ever was one. It's where Andrew Goodman of the Mississippi Burning murders back in the Civil Rights Movement in 1964 in Mississippi hailed from. In fact, I read somewhere that Andrew Goodman taught Elena Kagan's older brother how to ride a bicycle, if you can believe it. These people are all liberals. And Elena Kagan's hero and former boss, black NAACP lawyer and Supreme Court Justice Thurgood Marshall, was even too liberal for the legendary leftist Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. when Douglas expressed reservations about busing and reverse discrimination decisions like the Swan versus Mecklenburg case in the late 60s, early 70s, Justice Marshall reportedly chuckled, "You guys," Douglas was white, by the way, "have been discriminating against us for a long time. Now it's our turn." This is a perfect example of the thinking of the left that is in power here in America today, and it ought to be chilling for white people to hear this. Douglas and other white Gentile liberals need to learn that once you let the genie of liberalism out of the bottle, you can never control it, and you certainly can't put it back in. It's free to wreak unpredictable havoc on society. Blacks like Marshall, on the other hand, could give a deuce about principles of fairness or principle at all. It's all about payback in their minds. America needs to wake up, James, and, you know, here's another comment that I'd like to tell you about. You know, it's, for me, you know, I can't believe that someone as obviously unqualified as Elena Kagan is going to be appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court. She practiced law for only a few months and was obviously unsuited for it. That's why she moved on into academia. She has never tried a case. She made her first oral argument 18 months ago after being appointed Solicitor General, and she's been practicing law for over 25 years, or 20 years at least. She apparently, just as diversity means getting rid of white people nowadays, which is another one of James's blog entries, qualified means I graduated from Harvard. Kagan makes Harriet Myers, George W. Bush's nominee that was pilloried for being unqualified, seem overqualified. At least Harriet Myers was a partner in a large practicing law firm. She tried cases, and she made oral arguments, and she worked her way up from an associate to a partner in a law firm. Now, Elena Kagan hasn't done any of those things, but the silence is deafening from the news media that just howled like a bunch of hyenas about Harriet Myers. They have absolutely nothing to say except praise for Elena Kagan. I really think that the nation would be well served by prohibiting any Harvard grad from serving in government for the next 30 years. Where do they dig up specimens as weird as Kagan? 50 years ago, she couldn't have gotten a job as a library assistant in the Supreme Court. She's a weirdo. Anybody can look at her and see she's a weirdo. But today she's considered the very definition of a qualified candidate by the captive Jewish-run news media here in America because she's one of them. When will the Senate Republicans grow a spine and resist the liberal juggernaut that keeps serving up unqualified ideologues like Elena Kagan for positions on the Supreme Court? You know, she's a creep. You look at her, it's obvious she's a creep. She creeps me out every time that I look at her. You know, we have people like this running important positions in government, and meanwhile, a white male Gentile and a white Protestant has no place at the table anymore. There's not one of us on the U.S. Supreme Court, and we were the founding stock of America. That's why James says diversity means getting rid of white guys. Apparently, Kagan is a great advance towards diversity on the Supreme Court and in our government. You know, the Supreme Court is basically the last word in America when it comes to government. Luckily for us, at the present time, we have five somewhat conservative justices on the Supreme Court. There are nine justices total on the Supreme Court. So that means that we can win a few victories. You know, it's almost like things have been turned around 180 degrees from May 17, 1954, when the Brown decision was reached. When the Brown decision was reached, the only part of the federal government controlled by the left was the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, in 2010, the only part of the federal government the conservatives control is the Supreme Court. We're outgunned by liberals, liberal Democrats, liberal to moderate Republicans in the Senate, in the House of Representatives, and we have the most leftist president that we've ever had in America's history, Barack Obama, as our president. Now, people, if this doesn't wake you up and get you to move to action, I don't know what will. But Elena Kagan is bad news. We now have 3 Jews and 6 Roman Catholics on the Supreme Court. No Protestants whatsoever. No female Protestants. No white male Protestants. So, you know, it's amazing that we have been trained not to say anything about this. If there were no blacks on the Supreme Court, you think we wouldn't be hearing about it from the left, particularly from the black segment of the left?
Don't All right, Keith, hold it right.
Political cesspool, guys. We'll be back right after these messages. Get on the show and express your opinion in the political cesspool. Call us toll-free at 1-866-986-6397. We gotta
get out of this place. All right, we're back and seemingly at full strength, at least for now. Welcome back to the Political Cesspool Radio Program. I'm your host, James Edwards. It's evenings like these that I'm so thankful. Thankful more tonight than on usual nights. That I have people like Keith Alexander to carry my dead weight. As I sit over here and struggle with technical difficulties, he is taking the show in stride and leading it in the right direction. Welcome back to the program. Hopefully, no more interruptions forthcoming tonight. From time to time, this is one of the things that you love about live radio, wrinkles and all. You know that we're giving you something live, unrehearsed, and certainly uncensored. I want to remind everybody we have a little Independence Day incentive over at our website, thepoliticalcesspool.org. If you haven't yet reserved a copy of your book, if you've not yet bought a copy of my book, Racism Schmacism, How Liberals Use the R-Word to Push the Obama Agenda, now is the perfect night to do it because for tonight and tomorrow night only, in fact, this offer ends at 11:59 p.m. Central Time tomorrow night, 4th of July. Our Independence Day incentive is... You buy the book tonight, you get the book and a collectible limited edition political cesspool bumper sticker free of charge. That's our special offer, so go take advantage of it. Show your patriotic colors by supporting your favorite paleo-conservative talk radio program. Go to thepoliticalcesspool.org and make that purchase tonight. Read more about it there at the website. Now, Keith, one thing I was seeing today, and this wasn't on the agenda of things for us to address tonight, but I was watching... For the first time in my life, I just happened to be flipping through the channels, and I saw that the World Cup was on. I can't remember who was playing, but at the beginning of the game, before they did the national anthem, they had, and apparently this is something that's been going on the whole tournament, they have both team captains, both respective team captains, come up and read a statement about how bad racism is. It blew my socks off. You're going to think that this is so Orwellian that I'm exaggerating something here, but they have been having the team captains of every team in play over there in South Africa, of all places, which is so ironic because if we've ever been proven right about anything, South Africa and Nelson Mandela, the terrorist, have proven us right that we are not all just interchangeable parts. But nevertheless, they have the team captains come out and read this contrived statement about how bad racism is and how they stand for diversity in the World Cup. It just doesn't get any crazier than that, because if their argument was so ironclad, why would they have to shove it down our throats so grotesquely?
Well, they do it, James, because FIFA, FIFA as they call it, which is the world's governing board for what we call soccer, what the rest of the world calls football, is just as politically correct as the NBA and the NFL and Major League Baseball in America. You know, this is the treason of the elites. The reason soccer officials, you know, the elite in charge of worldwide soccer are opposed to this is because so many people in Europe are upset when they see non-whites, and particularly non-whites that have nothing to do with their country, representing their national team in the World Cup. And predictably, just as you and I would have predicted, whenever a white nation like France fields an all-black team or almost all-black team, it's disastrous. The French team, which was supposed to be one of the stronger teams in the tournament, left without getting to the round of 16. In other words, they didn't make the first cut because of infighting, squabbling, and petty bickering that is typical of minorities, which bedeviled the French team. This is what is, you know, quite frankly, it's, you know, they can make all the statements about being anti-racist all they want, but the World Cup itself is a showcase that of exactly why there are differences between the races and why, quite frankly, the white race is ahead in the world. Right now, it's almost 100% European World Cup semifinal. All of the South American teams, which are supposed to be the superior teams in the nation, I mean in the world, all of the African teams, all of the Far Eastern teams, they've all been swept out of the World Cup, much to the surprise and the chagrin and the horror of FIFA, ESPN, and the hierarchy of sports in the world generally. So, you know, I'm getting a big kick out of this World Cup. What it's showing is that we're right here at the political cesspool, and the elites that assume or presume to tell you what is right and what the world really is and how the world really is and that race is just a social construct with no reality, they're being proven abysmally wrong about their ideas, and we're being confirmed in ours, James.
Well,
quite frankly, that's
we are,
why
Keith,
I
and
like
I tell you, I really wish you could have seen what I saw today. It would have given you a whole nother look on this soccer tournament. I mean, that was so in your face and blatant.
They're having problems in Europe, particularly
you know, and another
fans.
Thing going on with boxing. You're talking about the success that the majority white nations have had in this tournament. Of course, heavyweight boxing is now totally dominated by white champions, European champions. And as a result of that, the Jewish gentleman who is in control of HBO Sports said they will never again, or at least for the current time until it becomes more diverse, they will not show any heavyweight boxing matches on HBO.
Well, you
now,
know, if you'll notice,
that's
a pattern throughout
seem very diverse
sports,
to me.
James.
It seems as though whoever's winning should have the same access to the American market. But what does diversity mean? Well, since we're on the topic of sports right now, diversity means, as I think we've established, certainly as we have established in my book, it means getting rid of white people. That's why the NBA, which is 80% black in a country where 13% of the population is black, is constantly being cited as a model for diversity. And we posted a story about this at thepoliticalcesspool.org that I'd encourage you to read. All of the four major sports leagues in America were audited recently, that being the NBA, NHL, Major League Baseball, and what's the other one, Keith? Hockey, basketball, football, and baseball.
Football.
They were
hockey,
all audited.
Football,
and basketball
baseball.
Got an A-plus in diversity. Basketball is 80% black. How is that diverse? But this is the story. The NBA leads the way in sports diversity. The NBA was, again, the only men's professional sports league to receive an A for race and gender in the annual report released Wednesday by the University of Central Florida's Institute for Diversity in Sports. So, again, 80% black in a country that only 13% of the population is black. How is that diverse? Well, this is the answer. Just like racism doesn't mean what it used to mean in terms of hatred or animosity towards people who don't look like you, the word racism doesn't mean what most white people think it means when liberals use it, and neither does diversity. It clearly means getting rid of white people, as this story makes blindingly obvious. I wrote about the NBA being a model for diversity, quote-unquote, and a bunch of other stuff in my book, Racism Schmacism. And if you want to understand what's up with all this garbage about diversity and racism, you really need to read it. It's an eye-opener. But, Keith, I know you've got some commentary on the NBA and what diversity means pertaining to that league.
Well, you know, your blog entry of June the 28th, 2010, where you said diversity is another word for getting rid of white people, that's one of the more profound and astute observations you've made in a lot, you know, quite frankly, ever. It is That's exactly what it's about. If diversity meant what Webster's Dictionary said diversity means, rather than getting an A from the Institute of Diversity and Ethics in Sports, which is a left-wing organization run by a cat named Richard Lapchick, ought to be Lapdog is what he ought to be called, Lapdog to the liberals, the NBA would be getting an F. Why is the NBA, that's almost 80% black, considered a model of diversity? Meanwhile, any sport in which whites come to the fore, we're told, is dying or dead and needs an infusion of color in order to win. For example, everybody in the golf at ESPN is wringing their hands because Tiger Woods no longer dominates. Major League Baseball has twice the percentage of blacks in the league as are represented in the population of the United States generally, but that's not nearly enough for the mavens of political correctness that run ESPN and run Major League Sports. So we're constantly being told that baseball is dying. Same thing with tennis. You know, now we don't have any black male stars, and we basically just have Serena and Venus Williams in tennis, women's tennis, so tennis is dying. I'm sure that after this World Cup, there's going to be a lot of hand-wringing and weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth at ESPN and at FIFA and all these other groups when the European teams show that they're better than all the rest of the world.
All right, we'll hold it right there. We'll be back with one more segment with Keith Alexander.
Don't go away. The Political Cesspool guys will be back right after these messages.
We got to get out of this place. It's the last thing we ever do. We gotta get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life.
Welcome back. To get on the political cesspool, call us on James's Dime, toll-free, at 1-866-986-6397. And here's the host of the political cesspool, James Edwards.
All right, welcome back to the show, everyone. James Edwards here with you. One final segment with Keith Alexander tonight, but much more forthcoming over the final 2 hours this evening. Coming up at the top of the second hour, Winston Smith, my co-host, is scheduled to be sitting in with me. Mel Gibson, our friend, in hot water again. This time he allegedly used the dreaded N-word. Oh, my God, did he not know that freedom of speech only includes certain words, and that it is a civil right that minorities be allowed to go through life without ever being offended. Well, he didn't get the memo, and it's going to cost him. And we're going to be talking about that at the top of the next hour. And some great guests tonight as well. Jimmy X from Radio X, one of the Liberty News Radio affiliates. He'll be with us, AM 1650 in Buffalo, New York, in the second hour. And Eddie the Bombardier Miller joining me in the third hour with a sheriff of one of these counties along the border who is fighting hard to put America first and protect our nation from this illegal alien invasion. Eddie and the sheriff with me in the third hour. So, ladies and gentlemen, this 4th of July Eve broadcast of the Political Cesspool is just getting started, I promise you. It's got started off hot and heavy this evening, technical difficulties notwithstanding. Keith Alexander and I have certainly gone through quite a bit of content so far. We kicked off the show by analyzing the need that the liberals feel we have for a living constitution. From there, we went into the Elena Kagan debate. Paul Gottfried said she is a perfect candidate for our times for the United States Supreme Court. Very tongue-in-cheek comment by Dr. Gottfried. And we talked about diversity in sports, or the lack thereof of diversity in sports, if you are coming from a pro-white perspective. And Keith Alexander now is going to conclude our line of thinking on that topic before moving on to one more subject. Keith?
You know, it is really scary when you think of how completely the elites that control everything that we do and access to most people's information. If you're not adept at the Internet, and if you don't have the information necessary to know how to find, for example, our program or the Council of Conservative Citizens or Occidental Observer or whatnot, where are you going to get accurate information. What's so scary is just what you said about boxing. You know, it's not just in the heavyweight divisions, James. Throughout all the weight divisions, white Eastern European boxers are dominating. So what does ESPN do? They've basically dropped coverage of boxing. You have two Jews, Bert Sugar and Teddy Atlas, and the only time you see a show on ESPN now about boxing is in the rare situation where you have a couple of blacks fighting for a championship or a run-up to a championship belt, or they trot out these old videotapes of Muhammad Ali, and they praise Muhammad Ali. He's kind of boxing's answer to Martin Luther King. But, you know, ESPN, which is totally dominated by Jewish interests, look at the names of all the people there. You've got Chris Berman, you've got Tony Kornheiser, Linda Cohn, Rich Eisen, Steve Levy, yada, yada, yada. You know, don't sound like a bunch of Irishmen to me. They have made the decision that whenever whites start to excel at a sport and they start to crowd out the black competition, like in golf, like in boxing, they just withdraw coverage. That's why we're getting so much NBA basketball, because that's the one area in which blacks seem to be doing pretty well, and it's probably because it's a sport that rewards, above all else, biological abnormality. Now, just think about this one thing first, and then we're going to move on to the next topic. Major League Baseball has to make amends for its unpardonable sin of having more white players than non-white players. So consequently, Major League Baseball has initiated this so-called RBI program, Return Baseball to the Inner City. You know, if blacks don't dominate a sport, then there has to be some pernicious honky plot afoot that is preventing them from reaching their normal and natural state of dominance in every sport. But on the other hand, the NBA has even fewer whites than Major League Baseball has blacks, but I don't see the RBS program, Return Basketball to the Suburbs, being sponsored by the NBA. You know, this should be that the light should be coming on over somebody's head right now. There is an anti-white regime that covers everything from sports to government to schooling to everything. They're basically not going to be happy, this ruling elite of cultural Marxists, not only in America but in the world. They're not going to be satisfied until we are pounded down to the bottom of the totem pole. They intend us to be the new serfs, as Paul Craig Roberts said in his articles about the new feudalism. We're the new serfs. And minorities are the new nobles. So, you know, nothing shows that quite as vividly as sports and sports coverage, James.
Keith, it's something that we could talk about for an hour. In fact, we will next week. Next week, Keith, I'm proud to announce, while we're on the subject, we will be interviewing for an hour Don Wassel, who, among other things, is the proprietor of Cast Football. .us, in fact, I think the only website on the internet that deals with these issues as they pertain to sports. So we're going to be, this is just opening up the can of worms tonight in this segment, ladies and gentlemen. Next week we're going to be talking much more about diversity, or the lack thereof, as it were, in sports with Don Wassel, who specializes on the subject. Now, Keith, we have but about 2 or 3 minutes left in this first hour. Do you have enough time, you think, to get into how gun control is racist? And we are used to the liberals throwing around the word racist and racism like confetti, because as my book clearly states, it stops conservative activists dead in their tracks when they do it. It paralyzes them with fear. But this time it was the so-called conservative Cato Institute who went into this soliloquy about how gun control itself is racist. Keith, what's the story there, if you have time?
Okay, there's a guy named David Ritger, who's apparently the token white Gentile at the National Review, and he wrote an article, and just like a typical mainstream conservative, they think that the way to attack every liberal notion and every liberal project is to say that it's racist. Now, gun control is racist. Unfortunately, Mr. Ritger doesn't know diddly squat about history. He said that racism created gun control in America. Confronted with the prospect of armed freedmen who could stand up for their rights, states across the South instituted gun control regimes that took away the ability of blacks to defend themselves against the depravity of the Klan. To that, I say bull hockey. That is the biggest lie that I've heard, in even in the mainstream media, in a long time. Somebody needs to tell Mr. Ritger that white Southerners were not in charge of their state governments during the aftermath of the Civil War, that aftermath period that lasted until 1877, when the Klan was born, was called Reconstruction. Blacks, scalawags, that's turncoat whites in the South, carpetbaggers, Northerners that came down and took advantage of the fact that white Southerners, particularly ex-Confederates, were denied the franchise and couldn't vote. They controlled the government. And if they passed gun control laws, it was not to protect blacks. It was to, it's just the opposite. The blacks didn't need protection. They had the government behind them. They also forget the Ku Klux Klan was formed to counter the violence of the Union Loyal Leagues and the Reconstruction governments run by people like Governor Parson Brownlow of Tennessee. He had a newspaper in Knoxville called the Rebel Ventilator, which expressed his opinion that all ex-Confederates should be shot and killed. So gun control, you know, if they were trying to protect black, you know, who needed protection? It was white Southerners, white ex-Confederates needed protection from blacks. And there was not an effort, you know, the white Southerners and the white ex-Confederates had no power in the government. So this guy is totally all wet. It's a stupid comment, but it's what you can expect from an organization like the National Review, James.
National Review, Cato Institute, they were responsible for this completely asinine and historically inaccurate commentary. But then again, that's another thing, another tenet of my book. This seems to be the neoconservative game plan. They're going to outpander the left for the minority votes, leaving the 60-70% of the population that's still of European American stock out in the cold. I don't think it's a winning strategy, Keith, but what do I know? I'm just a radio host.
Well, you know, I haven't seen them convert any black people to the Republican Party yet or to conservatism. But, you know, it doesn't matter how many times they fail. It doesn't matter how many times they appoint people like Otis Mathis, the ex superintendent of the Detroit schools, to a position of authority because he's black, and the guy falls flat on his face. They keep doing the same thing. They say insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results.
Keith,
the left is insane.
We're out of time, buddy. I love you. Let's talk to you next week. We'll be back with Winston Smith talking about Mel Gibson right after this.
Harv leaped to his feet and says, "Something's got a hold on me." Yeah! The day the squirrel went berserk in the First Self-Righteous Church in that sleepy little town of Pascagoula. It was a fight for survival that broke out in revival. They were jumping pews and shouting,
hallelujah.
Well, Harv hit the aisle,
okay,
statue
good.
And screamed. Some
I
thought
think,
he had religion, others thought he had a demon, and Harv thought he had a weed eater loose in his fruit of the looms. He fell his britches leg unobserved
working,
to the
it's
other
working.
Side of the room.
The IBM
all the way down to
my headset is working. No.